dreamed I was flying. Well, we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's alright. It's alright, it's alright. You can be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day. And I'm trying to get some rest. That's all I'm trying to get some rest.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, a long-postponed and long-awaited interview with Tom Doyle, including a wonderful reading, and Dan Persons has an interview of the movie Byzantium. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons, writer and critic for CineFantastic Online over at cfqonline.com. Director Neil Jordan is pretty much an unabashed romantic, to the point where the films that he makes that aren't fantasy still in some ways feel like they are, to the point where even the films that seem to be fantasy may turn out actually not to be. I won't cite specific titles here because the discovery is part of the kick. But it's that romanticism that's both the blessing and the curse of Byzantium, definitely a fantasy film, horror more specifically, and something of an unofficial sequel to Jordan's Interview with the Vampire. In present day, a 200-year-old mother and daughter team of vampires are on the run. They take refuge in a seaside town where the mother, played by Gemma Arterton, sets up a brothel in a sleazy hotel called the Byzantium, and the daughter, played by Saoirse Ronan, and tiring of her life of secrecy and desperation, strikes up a romantic relationship with a teenage boy dying of leukemia, who's played by Caleb Landry Jones. That relationship may be their undoing, as Ronan seeks to come out of the shadows, and a couple of mysterious pursuers continue their hunt. Jordan knows how to handle this stuff. As with his previous films, he can imbue settings, be they seedy or luxurious, with their own brand of sensuousness, and he creates a credible mother-daughter dynamic, both fractious and loving, between Arterton and Ronan. And he creates an interesting mythology here for his vampires, complete with an impressive conversion sequence in a mysterious shrine, and a secret brotherhood that oversees the process and doesn't take kindly to women availing themselves of those powers, whether for good or ill. But Jordan maybe wants too much of this film, and there is the sense that he's jamming too many pegs into a single hole. He wants this to be a mother-daughter bonding tale, and a Twilight Saga-style teen romance, and a tale of liberation with women struggling against a calcified patriarchy. There isn't any reason it can't be all these things, but as done here, the pieces don't hum together, and there's too much the sense of things happening because that's what's supposed to be happening, as opposed to rising naturally from the story. That's particularly true towards the end, when Jordan wishes to orchestrate a change in the way we regard one of the main characters, without doing anything to set us up for the change beyond having another character tell us why we should feel that way. As good a filmmaker as Jordan can be, and as admirable as his motivations may be, his powers fail him here, and the film exits on a sense of a promise unfulfilled. But while it lasts, there is promise to Byzantium, and it's worth seeing for its performances, its atmosphere, and its unique take on Gothic romanticism. I'm Dan Persons. Stay up to date on what's going on in the world of fantastic film and TV over at cfqonline.com.
And not to mention the fact that Dan recorded that for here. I am going to take a slight dissent. As people know, make a point of almost not going to vampire movies or anything like that, but I did on Sunday. I went with my partner and with Margot Adler. And, you know, if you're going to go see a vampire film, Margot is the right person to do it. And by the way, don't forget her new book about the current vampire craze is out on, just go to margotadler.com, margotadler.com, and it's called Out for Blood, and as Margot puts it, it's cheaper than an ice cream cone. It's an Amazon single. It's really, you know, an essay, and a rather good one. At any rate, I thought the movie gelled perfectly. I thought that all of these individual parts and like that worked as a whole very, very nicely. And, you know, this from somebody who doesn't like this kind of cinema in general. I thought it was clever. I thought the reveals were very good. I think the review that we just heard, in fact, gives, and a lot of the reviews I've read, just saying that it's mother-daughter, they don't tell you until, like, you know, 35 minutes into the film, it's mother-daughter. This is not on the level of Neil Jordan. You know, she's a guy, but it's, you know, the less said about it, the better. Other than, as vampire stories go, this is an unusual one and heartily recommended, even if, like me, you are allergic to gore. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM. For a long time, I have been trying to get Tom Doyle on the air. Tom is a wonderful writer. I see him usually at Washington, D.C., science fiction conventions, and at a few others. And he has a new book out, plus some other stuff in the works that we will hear about. And every single time, it's three times in total that we have scheduled him to be on the show, instead, you know, either a preemption or a fundraising drive took place. So we said the hell with it, and we recorded this at my house. Therefore, you will hear lawnmowers, you will hear airplanes, and unfortunately, during the reading, you will occasionally hear my hand moving as I move the mic. This is something I'm going to have to correct in the future, and I'm actually building sort of like a mini studio at my place to deal with this in the future. Nevertheless, the content is excellent and very good. And by the way, it runs almost, well, right up until the end of the program at 3 a.m. So with no further ado, we take you back in the Wayback Machine to May 15th of this year. And by the way, happy 4th of July. And now, by the magic of recording, I introduce you to Tom Doyle. We will start by slating this, as it were, by saying today is May 15th, indeed. I believe, the Ides of May.
Yes, beware.
Indeed. Well, May, not March, and mid-afternoon.
Okay.
The Brooklyn, my personal Brooklyn studios. So with me is Tom Doyle.
Hi, Tim. Good to see you.
Likewise. And this is our third attempt at getting Tom live on the air, and it just didn't happen, usually because every single time we tried to do it, how do you know when WBAI is going to go into a fun drive? You can tell because that means I've got Tom scheduled to do a show.
I'm a Jonah. I'm clearly cursed, but we're getting it done, so I couldn't be happier.
Oh, there's a thought. The Jonah of the airwaves.
Yes. or the flying Doyle or something like that that just can never put into land and get the interview done.
Yes,
it has to always be at sea. Cue Wagner in the background.
Yes, exactly. So who am us anyway? I don't think I've mentioned I'm Jim Freund. I have mentioned that you're Tom Doyle. Who be Tom Doyle?
Tom Doyle writes science fiction and fantasy in Washington, D.C., and lately I've put a collection together of my short stories that Lawrence Schoen has published through his Paper Golem Press.
Right.
And Tom Doyle's had a great year.
He was going to send me a copy, and he never did.
But I've brought one for you.
Well, thank you.
No.
I have to get after Lawrence.
Oh, he's been a busy. You know, he's a busy guy. He's got a lot of fingers in a lot of creative
places.
Pies,
and
I'm just very happy. I mean, he's done this twice before for other collections for newer authors, and he's been pretty lucky so far as far as calling.
Oh, he has good taste.
He has good taste. He had Cat Rambo for his first, and then Eric James Stone for his second.
Right.
So I hope I continue the winning pattern here.
Now, in terms of short, I mean, it's very, very difficult for short story writers to get anything published without having novels. We'll get to that first. There's just not the market. If you sell short stories on a regular basis, which you do, you can get, $25 from one from a good magazine.
Yeah, it's not a living these days. That's true for most people. I mean, some folks, I'm sure, are making a kind of living off of the short story markets. But for most of us out there,
very few.
But exactly that's why Lawrence has kind of set himself this niche of folks who seem to be are going to be doing novels soon, but their short work might kind of be left behind unless he, you know, goes out there, brings it together, and puts out a collection with it. He's trying to anticipate rather than wait for the novel and then go back in mind, because by then, you know, it's science fiction. Some of these stories can get pretty stale after time goes too long.
Yeah.
Your cutting edge, you know, view of social trends and anticipating social media or something becomes yesterday's news if too many years go by, and a lot of years can go by before
And sometimes by the time they're published, I think Kim Stanley Robinson, with his Mars trilogy, by the time the third book came out, there was stuff that was scientifically passé from the first book, having to do with permafrost and what they understood about it and its capability of being on Mars or not. I don't remember exactly what it was, but yeah, his book was... he writes it, gets probably, what, 18-month lead time if he's lucky?
Yeah, you know, that would be very fortunate.
If they race it to print,
yes,
there'll be 18 months, and by the time the third book in the trilogy comes out, and writing hard science fiction, something will have been, some theory will have muted.
Yeah, you know, you can try to write some elaborate write-around of, oh, but it was this or that or the other thing, but people see it.
Yeah, he was smart. He didn't bother.
Yeah, you didn't.
He just said, this is, you know, the universe at the time that I wrote it, and so be it. Now, people know that I use the world's loosest definition of science fiction. I use what a lot of people call the Damon Knight definition, which is science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Yeah.
So therefore, Kelly Link is science fiction.
I would hope so. She was one of my Clarion instructors, so I'm a big fan of hers.
Yeah, but of course, when you read The Girl Detective, you say, well, how so? That's just... Or Karen Russell is a great example, you know, where she has a short story in which a number of presidents have been reincarnated as horses and they're in a stable talking to each other. But you actually write the real thing.
Absolutely. I write science fiction. Some of it's near future hard SF. Mm-hmm. Some of it's far future edgy SF.
Yeah.
And then I also do fantasy and some slipstreamy, just kind of odd stuff that would be in stricter definitions might not fit any.
Wouldn't fit the Lester Del Rey test.
Yeah.
I think that's a good one, because he's the one who would come on the air and years ago when he was around and say, Samuel R. Delaney's never written a science fiction book in his life.
Oh my gosh. Triton, not...
No. Can Triton hold an atmosphere? How did they? How?
Oh, I see. This is real analog, hardcore, hard SF. If your world building doesn't hold up, then
yeah, exactly. I mean, he said, "Now, you want to call it fantasy? I love fantasy. Fantasy is great, but it's fantasy, you know." But he was hardcore, and he would fight over it. And he did a lot of it on the radio on Long John Nebel's show.
Well, yeah, this is the sort of, going back to the John W. Campbell sort of what, you know, we're going to have the facts right, except for things like ESP, et cetera, which get in there somehow.
And yet John W. Campbell published Dianetics, go figure.
Yes.
he had a monthly column in Astounding, right, that was... You know, questionable science.
Yeah, for all the...
It's called, like, Probability... Probability Zero is a short story by N.K. Jemisin, but...
I forget.
It might have actually still been Probability Zero.
It was very odd for all the insistence on kind of the scientific verisimilitude, how many odd things yet crept into his...
Yeah,
definitions of what science.
But he was in the birthing days.
Yes,
and in fact, he was one of the midwives, and he had a science fiction magazine. He had his fantasy magazine, Unknown. Was it just unknown or unknown stories? Or not unknown stories, that would be rude, yeah. but tales of unknown, something like yeah. that would not fit into Astounding.
Right.
And, yeah, he took those definitions seriously. But having said that, there is such a thing as real, bona fide science fiction, which takes science, extrapolates from it, does the what if.
I've been, when asked by folks who do not necessarily read a lot of genre, I go with the breakdown usually of that if everything is not scientifically forbidden, as far as the science we know,
uh-huh.
if the speculative element isn't forbidden in that way, then it's science fiction. If it's something that we, according to our science today, know to be impossible, then
it's either fantasy
or something else.
Or a wonderful term, science fantasy.
Science.
Which is basically, I don't care.
Which is Star Wars, basically.
That is, yes, Star Wars is exactly that. It is the epitome, I think, of science fantasy. And a lot of Lee Brackett's writing and all that, but of course, come to think of it.
And that intersects, actually.
Well, it does intersect. Lee Brackett wrote Empire Strikes
right,
Back,
yes.
So I was thinking, gee, what a coincidence.
Yes. Absolutely.
Take that away. You had, now, what is it? Is it 2 years, 3 years since you got the award for short story in a small press, or what it's the WSFA.
The WSFA award.
Yeah, WSFA being the Washington
Science
Fiction
Association. Yeah, that's actually 5 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Time has flown.
Oh, my God. That's horrid.
That was 2008.
Yeah, I was there, so. Yeah.
Time has flown.
Yeah, but part of the problem is I've missed a capclave in there.
Ah, that's right. And Sandy interfered with you this past year.
Yeah.
For one.
Yeah.
And, and that was for the story called The Wizard of Macatawa. And so the collection is titled The Wizard of Macatawa and Other Stories for that reason. That's kind of one of my flagship stories, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And having gotten that award. That's a fantasy story, but it has a lot of science fiction-y tropes in it, but definitely fantasy in that magic seems to be working.
And that wizard word is sort of a giveaway, unless you're talking about the Wizard of Menlo Park.
Exactly.
The wizard word, yeah, sort of is a cue.
And it does tie into the Oz world and Frank Baum's real life. But once you tie into Oz, even if you're giving it some science fiction-y explanations, it goes in the fantasy box.
It generally does. It was, by Jeff Ryman, sort of walks the borderline.
Yeah, that's just interesting, that one. I don't know put it.
Let's not define it, other than great novel.
Yeah.
It's a weeper, folks, if you're listening. It's WAS, by the way, and yes. Well worth reading. I'm sorry, I just started thinking of Jeff Ryman, who I last saw in Washington, as a matter of fact.
Well, for The Nebulas was that, when he
That's
won.
Right.
He,
That's
he
right.
won the award that year.
Yes, I spent a lot of time using my phone trying to get just the right shot of him happily, I was going to use the word stroking, petting his award. I got it.
Fondly.
Fondling.
Fondly. Yeah.
He really was. He really was. And couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Now, why short fiction? Many people start out. David J. Williams, a former Washingtonian, just started out saying, I'm going to write novels. In fact, I'm going to write trilogies.
Oh, yeah. And he was he's a good friend of mine, actually.
Uh-huh.
And he acknowledged in the collection.
Yeah, but he's a traitor. He moved to the West Coast.
He did. And then I don't like that part, and it's I do still talk to him, though. And yeah,
and by the way, David, if you're hearing this, you're supposed to come back just to do the radio show. But sorry, go on.
I would hope so. And he's yes, that completely stunned. I think it stunned him as much as anyone that, you know, he does his hard SF trilogy, goes out, sells the 3-book deal, you know, comes right out and has it right into books, right into novels. And he is the, I don't know that that's a quite so common a thing. It seemed pretty rare, but well deserved.
It's not, well, in fantasy, it's not uncommon at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, fantasy, it's, you know, you walk into an office, if you virtually, and they say, okay, what's your trilogy about?
Yeah. And in the longer lengths in general and all that.
They're all assuming, it's all ironic, because they're all trying to copy the Tolkien model, except Tolkien didn't want his book to be a trilogy.
No, that was a split up novel. For marketing a long novel, yeah.
Yeah.
It was too big for, you know, a lot of it's just the physical size of these things and the binding that has to go into them. And
so what about the short form appeals to you?
Well, for starters, it appealed to me because I was learning my craft. And it's, you know, to be frank about it, it's easier to start telling stories with a beginning, middle, and an end when they aren't doorstopper length and mm-hmm. figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And I went to Clarion early on, and that's a workshop that is about short fiction. You can bring your parts of a novel there, but you're really not getting out of it what you should.
One of the reasons that I've always loved to promote Clarion is because it focuses on the short story. This is, by the way, a 6-week workshop.
It is a boot camp.
Yeah, it really is. And you were at Clarion West?
I was at Clarion East, original Clarion. Clarion, okay. No modifier. And it was when it was still in East Lansing. I was one of the last classes there.
Although, of course, unless I'm mistaken, it started in Clarion.
In Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Yes.
And
about half a mile from Virginia Kidd's house.
But it had been at MSU for quite some time, even since I was a little kid, I believe. Yes. And they had, and that's where I grew up. And I had always wondered as a child, well, what are all these science fiction writers doing in town?
Michigan. And,
what are they? Is Lansing, that typical? Yeah. Do they go on tour? Why are they here?
Yeah.
And so it was like going home.
That's great.
Yeah.
So who were your teachers?
That year we had Howard Waldrop starting off.
Oh God!
And that was a really, you know, talk about hitting the ground running. There wasn't a whole lot of orientation or preview. We were right into the thick of it.
Yeah, and for listeners, that's Waldrop. If you see the name, read it. Just talk about somebody who can write great short stories, great humor, and all that, and, you know, it should be a household name, but like the great short...
Massive amount of research goes into some of his historical base, both historical culture, literary, you know, kind of mining early 20th century literary stuff, 20th century film, massive amounts of knowledge kind of distilled down
and he does it for the love.
Yes,
he does it for the love. He's purely a short story writer.
That's
so that Waldrop. So
the, and then Nalo Hopkinson.
Okay,
who
has a new book out, by the way.
Yes, that's right, and I still need to get it because I'm a Nalo Hopkinson completist. I do, you know, everything she writes.
Everybody listening should be.
Yes. And then it was Richard Paul Russo. After that, who his Carlucci trilogy is probably his most famous of his works, mm-hmm. but he's done many other novels as well. I think he won the Philip K. Dick Award and various and you know, I've stayed in touch with all of these. Well, except for Howard, he's more difficult to stay in touch with, but the other folks still in touch with them, still big fans of all the work. Next was Kelly Link and Gavin Grant.
Who together are Small Beer Press, yes. And both of them good writers, but Kelly Link has, she's the breakthrough. She's the one who made her way into Time magazine for being self-published and writing some of the best stuff and being undefinable. Although we all agree, if it's, you know, we use the word science fiction or we use the term speculative fiction or slipstream or interstitial or...
Yeah, it's great that someone who has such literary chops has been completely embracing of being called a science fiction or fantasy or, you know, just genre speculative author, and accepts it, and that's, you know, her community and her people, because that's...
Because there are some very highbrow literary writers who write purely science fiction who...
Do not accept
who
the
do
target
not
label.
Accept Atwood.
Yes.
Something no caught my throat there. But
no, so that's great. And she's such...
and for a little while, Jonathan Lethem.
Yes.
But he recanted.
No, he's much more accepting than Atwood on that front. But Kelly's, you know, completely... They were both, you know, extremely... helpful on issues of craft and just, you know, great.
And they're
people.
Both great editors.
Yes.
They have a good eye.
Absolutely.
For what it is they do.
And just nice people.
Yeah.
And then we had for the anchor team, the last 2 weeks, was Maureen McHugh and James Patrick Kelly.
Wow. Okay.
And with editor, the kind of editor on hand was Scott Edelman.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
Okay.
And, who later introduced me to my local writing group. So, and I still see a lot of him. And Jim Kelly was kind enough to write the intro for the collection.
Oh, great.
And it was
and he's
was
also
very
a person
generous.
who puts audio science fiction in very high regard.
Yes. A great reader. I enjoy listening to his podcasts all the time. And he and Maureen McHugh are both great, very distinctive personalities.
I've never met her. I've always wanted to.
Oh, yeah. And she's someone who's kind of been on featured on NPR considerably as someone who's, you know, has the literary chops and yet gets embraced, you know, does self-defines as a science fiction and fantasy author. So one of these people who bridges... the communities very effectively. And she's, you know, Jim brings the very high energy, you know, sort of approach at Clarion and elsewhere. And Maureen brings a very, you know, reflective, focused sort of approach. And the two of them very much balanced each other ideally.
Yeah.
In that way, you know, that you'd get this sort of different voices attacking the manuscript from different angles.
So how, so the Clarion, yeah, it's boot camp, and it's really, there are very, very few people I know who have gone through Clarion who then didn't become professional writers. One of them is Margot Adler, who created Hour of the Wolf, but... It was because she went to Clarion that I took over the show.
Ah, there you go.
But, you know, darn it, Margot, start writing.
Well, I've had some classmates who have been doing well. I've not everyone has continued.
Yeah, who's
with
in your year?
Well, we have Will McIntosh, who's been doing quite well. He's won some awards. I believe he won the Hugo.
I think he did.
And he has a new novel coming out. And we had Stephanie Dre, who under her own name and Stephanie Draven has been having a great deal of publishing success. Her books about Cleopatra's daughter, Cleopatra Selene, have been doing quite well. She's just finishing up the third book in that trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And just a marvelous historical and fantasy writer. So the two of them have been doing well. Some of the others have continued to write and do well also, but I think some, you know, not everyone does continue, actually, and some folks...
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into that one day.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, A, most of the good writers who I've had on the show, and there have been many, certainly after a certain year, I would say starting with the 1980s, I would say I've had more than half were Clarion grads, and then a couple from Odyssey and a couple from...
It's extremely helpful if people have the time to devote 6 weeks of their lives to this, to their writing career.
Yeah.
Then they should take this opportunity.
And there are scholarships, by the way.
There are. It is one of the more affordable. This isn't like the sort of Hollywood screenwriting things which seem to be about taking people's money and giving them very little in return, as far as I can tell.
But the problem is you have to be able to afford to take six weeks.
That's the real cost. It's that economic opportunity cost of the 6 weeks rather than the money
and
you're
the travel.
Spending. And the travel. But once you're there, you're probably spending about the same amount of money that it would take you to live anywhere.
Yeah. I was accepted to Clarion West, and I never went.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, well, it was expensive.
Yeah.
It was, you know...
It
was in Seattle, I believe, that year. This is 1974. I didn't have the money, although there was... the money could have been found.
Yeah.
But there was also a bribe, because Margot Adler, who had created the radio show, told me if she went, and she was also accepted, if she went, I could just, you know, be the host of her show for those 6 weeks. And when she came back, she took a different time slot.
And here we are today. On that note, I mean, that's how we are here today.
Yeah. And we should tell people that you're listening to Hour of the Wolf, presumably over WBAI in New York City. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Tom Doyle, who has actually come up from Washington largely for this, meet an editor.
Yes.
And then go to the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series at 184 East 4th Street, which is the evil competition to the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series.
Oh, yeah. But it's great to be able to time all this together. And, I'll be talking with my editor after we're done here about the novel that's coming out next year.
Ooh, the N-word.
The N-word. So it has happened, and I have a three-book deal with Tor.
See how it's always three books?
It's coming through. Well, and that's...
Now, are they... When you say a three-book deal, that doesn't mean a trilogy, or
does it? It means a series. Maybe it means just a trilogy, but it could...
It could go beyond that, but it starts with...
It starts with three books, and it's going. The first book is going to be called American Craftsman, and going to be a contemporary fantasy with military and skullduggery elements, based on an idea, a lot of historical and literary backdrop. It basically takes the idea that... there's a lot of crypto history, a lot of Tim Powers sort of history in the background to what people are doing today.
Mm-hmm.
So not spending time back there in history, maybe in the later volumes, but everyone's kind of looking back over their shoulder at this heavy burden of the past that these families have.
Okay, and why craftsmen?
Because these sort of magician soldiers are practicing craft or witchcraft.
Ah, okay, that kind of craft.
Yeah, that kind of craft. So they are American craftsmen.
Speaking of Margot Adler, craft.
Sort of craft. And drawing down the moon sort of craft.
Exactly, exactly. And because I also used to work a crafts fair, and there weren't too many Wiccans there. I could never understand why.
Well, then some of them overlap with that stuff, but yes.
Yeah, and darn well they should, come to think of it, yeah. You go to a huckster room at a science fiction convention, and you're very, very likely to find beautiful things in leather and wood with pentacles on them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the series, and it's being edited by Claire Eddy, and it was Bob Thixton at Pinder Lane is my agent, and he's the one who sold it to her. And at first, when I heard some initial indications of interest, I said, well, be sure to let her know I'd be willing to do another book. It has a kind of slingshot ending if they want something else. And they came back and said, why not three?
That's what they like.
That's what they like.
They like, for many reasons, because if people like the first, you have a built-in sales, built-in audience for what goes after that.
And it's great for me. I know what I'm doing the next couple of years.
And there's also, interestingly, sort of a trend that's been happening with credible fantasy / military.
Yes. Well, we have Mike Cole's series of books have been done. So you have stuff that's being done in the contemporary world on that line, and you also have stuff going backwards in time, where the medieval, pseudo-medieval settings are getting less pseudo as far as the military elements. It's like, what would these folks actually be wielding? And I think the whole Mongoliad project, for example, was about Neal Stephenson's and others, and a classmate of mine, Nicole Gallen, and a bunch of other writers got together on their kind of medieval weapons geeks, among other things, and why can't we get this right? Why can't we collectively write something that gets the martial combat of this period correct instead of what usually gets put out there?
Yeah.
So, exactly.
And then there's any number of stuff that involves the Napoleonic Wars.
Oh, yes.
Naomi Novik with her Temeraire novels, with dragons coming up alongside, the Horatio Hornblower types. And Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which isn't military related, but it does coincide in era.
Yes. No, absolutely. And I was, Mary Robin at Colwell is just taking a stab at that period
well. Yeah, with Regency. Yeah. But closer to Jane Austen than it is.
But the second book is more like Vanity Fair in that the characters end up in Belgium in 1815, so you get into the military elements a little bit there.
Yeah, but you wouldn't call it military.
By
any means.
No.
She's a bit more interested in simply the era.
Yeah.
Than in the war, whereas Naomi's work is clearly about, let's start with, there's a battle, there's a war going on, and Mary sort of takes a step out of Bath, and discovers, oh, there's a war around us.
Yeah, so it takes it a step further than Jane Austen ever would, but not as far as Novik's stuff, no.
Yeah,
that's true.
And the only reason Austen would have soldiers in there is because they're marriageable.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's war going on in the background and such, and that's why the soldiers are there to be flirted with and have unsuitable alliances
with. Yes.
But yes. So so that's
that's
what I'm working on for. Right now, that's what's keeping me busy. So not writing as many short stories. I just had one that appeared in Daily Science Fiction, which was, that's what one of my Clarion classmates is doing. Instead of writing a whole lot, he's publishing. Jonathan Layden of Daily Science Fiction and his wife, Michelle Lee Barrasso, are putting out Daily SF, which it's free. You get an email every day with your morning commute of usually short science fiction or fantasy stories. I recommend you go to dailysciencefiction.com and get on their list, and you'll have this better than the newspaper, and it's completely good for the commute length stuff. People have been enjoying that.
So yeah,
that was fun to be part of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as you were saying, with the lead times on publication, talking about Kim Stanley Robinson stuff, it will not be until next year, spring or summer 2014, that the first of my books
time, maybe we'll actually get you on the air live.
But that, yes.
Or whatever form this show takes. God knows what's going on with the radio station. Well, let's not discuss it.
I'd love to come back. It's a lot of fun.
I mean, it's awful that it's been this long.
But yeah, and that's all my fault.
Hardly.
With these three, recent ones, that's acts of God or whatever.
Hardly God.
Or a prom, some chthonic Lovecraftian deity messing with our lives.
Not even elder gods. Yeah. It's just, you know, newer gods of mischief. Tricksters.
Tricksters.
There we go.
Minor league Lokis interfering with our...
I like that phrase. Minor league Lokis. Comes up with a great idea for a baseball story.
That's right, yeah. Because it's in the name. He's Loki.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that one I've thought of before. Yeah. I don't know if it's been done. But minor league. Yeah, there's a thought.
Minor league Loki. Yeah, it's like, what's it? Bull Durham with a mischief deity. There you go.
That kind of thing. And it's so true. Where I live in Brooklyn, I'm within shouting distance of the Brooklyn Cyclones, which are a minor league team owned by the Mets.
Well, there you go.
And to me, that's fun baseball.
Oh, it is. I've been to... my partner Beth Delaney is a huge Red Sox fan.
Ah, okay.
And so, now a Nats fan, but we've seen some of the minor league games as well. We've seen the Iron Pigs.
I was going to say something really awful. I go, when you're a Nats fan, you are a minor league fan. But I say this as a former Mets fan. I've seen better baseball in the minor leagues. And we are Tom Doyle, and I am Jim Freund. I guess there's a we and I in there somewhere. And this is being recorded on May 15th. And Tom is going to read us a major portion of a... Is it a novelette or a short story?
It is a novelette in length.
By the usual division.
So it's a long one. So I'll be reading a major portion of it. And for folks who want to listen to the rest of it afterwards, they'll be able to go to my website, and I'll tell them about that
and
at the end of
denouement.
The story. And get the denouement.
Okay, very good. But why don't you tell people the website now and after?
Okay. Well, the website is TomDoyleWriter.com. And there's a section on the website.
And let's spell that all out.
Okay. TomDoyleWriter.com. And it has a section on there that you'll see devoted to audio. And if you go there, you'll find a link to the complete audio of this story, which is Noise Man. And you can... either listen to the beginning again or
as if to give us noise in the background.
Well, in the background. But I thought this would be appropriate for any number of reasons. It's a story that has a New York setting. It has a character who's obsessed with the technologies of radio and other related technologies at the time. And I think I couldn't imagine doing a better story for Hour of the Wolf.
Thank you. So, we shall begin.
Noise Man. Sunday, October 30th, 1938. On the night they didn't say hello, Kenny O'Reilly listened to his just-completed radio. He closed his eyes, smarting from the poor light, and tuned in some jazz. Nice. His brain jumped along to the beat, singing designs of wires and tubes and things better than tubes. Kenny, dinner. His mother's tenement flat voice snapped him out of his circuits. Mom must have held on dinner as long as she could, but his father's steps weren't near yet. Kenny huffed the completed radio to the living room. Can I test it out during dinner, Mom? She murmured a yeah. Dad had said that he had to fix some plumbing in the Bell Labs building, where he was the super. Often he didn't stumble back until after midnight, even on a Sunday. He promised over and over that someday he was going to shuffle them out of Hell's Kitchen into a real house. Not that their life played as bad as their neighborhood sounded. Dad worked as super for this building, too, so the flat for the three of them was spacious compared with their neighbors. And even more important, the electricity performed. Dad's going to be sorry he missed this pot roast, Kenny said, smacking his lips. The Bergen-McCarthy routine came through loud and clear on the new radio. Kenny's radios always sounded better than the buzzing junk in the stores. Kenny had composed his first crystal set from odd bits of wire and a diode Dad had scrounged for him from the lab's waste bins. He had been 3 years old. He had progressed steadily through every related gadget he could make, transmitters, antennae, selling his earlier efforts to fund his purchases of more equipment, always improving, always improvising. Not a bad racket for a 13-year-old. Mom just sat at the table, eating nothing, not seeming to hear him when he laughed at Charlie McCarthy. He listened. Her breathing sounded tired. Tired and something else. She might be a little sore. He should be extra helpful cleaning up after dinner. Dorothy L'Amour started singing some mushy number. Kenny got up to change the station. Ah, a swing band. But then some announcer came on.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Despite the New Jersey location, Kenny quickly recognized the science fiction of The War of the Worlds. One of the actors did the shadow, too. Kenny could always distinguish the man under the character.
What evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
The reporter's microphone crashed, signaling that the Martians had got him. Mom's chair squeaked. Kenny had been so wrapped up in the program that he had forgotten about Mom. Kenny, we have to go. Get your things together. She spoke with deliberate calm, but Kenny could sense the fear. She went into her bedroom and began to slam open drawers and throw clothes on the bed. She sniffed. Had she been crying? Oh, crap. She believed this junk. Mom, it's not real. She didn't pause. When her bags were full, she dragged Dad's spare toolkit from under the bed and pulled off the socket tray. Clang, rattle. She reached into the kit and fished out a big wad of bills, the most money Kenny had ever seen. She stuffed the bills in a bag with her dresses. Hurry up, boy. There isn't much time. Come on, Mom. Think about it. It wouldn't be worth any Martian's plug nickel to come here. Yes, I know. Now get packing. But you don't understand. She pressed her hands down hard on Kenny's shoulders. No, you don't understand. We have to leave. Now. Kenny was stunned. Mom sounded nuts. What about Dad? She turned away from him and went back to shoving clothing and jewelry into shabby bags. He'll be fine. I'm not going. Mom stopped again. She grabbed Kenny by the arm and pulled him towards his room. Now! Can't wait! Not another minute! I'll die! But Kenny pulled against her. I can't leave Dad! He couldn't bear to even sound like a coward to his father. You just go. She spoke right at him, her lips quivering. Honey? Her voice had a strange crack in it. He rushed to reassure her. I'll just wait here to tell Dad. We'll catch up with you later, up north. Then we can all skedaddle together. Kenny was talking on his feet. Mom wouldn't get far before she heard the Martians weren't real. Then she would just snap back. Kenny would try to keep Dad calm until then. It was the best plan, though it might cost him a piece of his hide. Mom sighed, as if he had just beaten her in a long race. Okay, Kenny, you win. I'll meet you up north. When you're ready, just call Aunt Maureen. She'll know where. She finished filling two bags and dragged them to the door. Dropping the bags, she hugged Kenny hard. "I love you, honey. I will always love you. Don't let anyone ever tell you different." And then, snick-snack, she was out the door. An hour later, Dad stumbled in, out of breath and dirty from work. Kenny started to explain about Mom and the Martians. "Martians? What kind of malarkey is this? She's run off with some flim-flam man, hasn't she, boy?" "No, it was the shadow guy on the radio, and bam!" Dad smacked his ear, as if he knew that that was the worst thing he could do. Kenny just took the blow, always easiest not to fight it, and braced for the next smack. But Dad only stared at his huge, calloused hand. Then he sank into a chair and started to cry. Kenny had never heard his father cry. It was the scariest, saddest sound he had ever known. He started to cry, too. Dad reached for him with one of his big hands. "It's okay, boy. Everything's going to be fine." His voice became more even. "There aren't any Martians. Your mother will be back soon." And that was how Kenny learned for certain that he could tell someone was lying just from the music of their voice. The next day, when his father's footsteps trailed off in the stairwell, he telephoned his Aunt Maureen, the dreaded Irish Republican aunt. "Not here yet," she snapped. No point in talking further. It was expensive. But after he hung up, he wondered, would he have to call again, or would Mom call him? Either way, Dad would pound him if he found out. Kenny had always had Mom muffling Dad for him. Kenny wanted to hear what his dad would do next, but he also wanted to stay out of his way. So, Kenny played hooky and wired the flat for sound. His radios were already in every room, their decorative boxes plenty large to conceal microphones and trailing wires. But if a radio was turned on, it would make listening difficult. So he also found other spots for mics, like behind the headboard of Dad's bed. Wearing headphones, Kenny could quietly attend to each mic. He also tapped the phone line. He could just listen, or he could join in on a call, or he could take the call over, disconnecting the regular telephone. A soft shoe tap dance. Safely in his room, he could hear everything. The next day, Kenny caught screaming hell at school, but it was a short day for All Saints, so it wasn't so bad. That night, sure enough, bring! Just as his father stepped in the door. Kenny paused a measure for his father to pick up, and then tapped in. "Hello, Will, is that you?" "Maureen, where's my wife?" Aunt Maureen's light lilt dueled with his father's like a duet about a haining. "My sister isn't here. I want to speak with Kenny. Could you please put him on the phone?" "My boy won't be speaking with any of yous, you lying whores. Now put my wife on the phone." Kenny heard his opportunity. He flipped the switch and disconnected his father. He heard his father slam the receiver into its cradle with a "God damn it!" Kenny spoke as quietly as Aunt Maureen could hear. "It's Kenny. Is she there?" "I'm going to Patty's," his father yelled and slammed the door. His mom came on the phone. "Kenny? Oh, my baby, I'm so sorry." Syncopated crying sounds. "It's okay. I didn't understand. I'm coming. Where can I meet you?" His mother hesitated. I need to check with my friend, Kenny. He's a nice man, a very nice man. I'm sure you'll like him. I know he'll like you." There it was again. Lies. They rang like atonal church bells in Kenny's ears. A hell of a choice. The commanding devil he knew, or this unheard friend. The need for his mother turned to moot stone inside him. "Maybe you should get things settled with your friend first." "Are you sure?" The relief outweighed any doubt in her voice. "What about your father?" "I can play him." He heard his own words and realized that he believed what he was saying. He would just have to keep his ears open. Saturday, September 2nd, 1939. Saturday night, Dad brought another woman home. Her voice was old and full of cigarettes and booze, like Dad's, only more perfumed. Dad insisted on introducing her to Kenny. Then they tumbled into Dad's room. And Kenny listened. He always listened. They used few words, but many invitations, codes, calls, and responses. They lied a lot to each other, but neither sounded like they cared. The rhythm of bed noise was not quite even, but not quite jazz either. He almost forgot that she was a stranger and not his mom. He missed his mom. But Dad never got mean with these strangers. Was it like this with Mom and her friend now? The sounds of music and bodies and bed wove together in his mind, building and building like a freight train coming towards him, random tones reaching up for a resolution. Boom! A fat transcendent chord hung in the air, obliterating tension and thought. Yes. His dad breathed heavily. No more interesting noise. Kenny switched to the radio while he tinkered with his latest composition, a portable battery-powered radio for his dad to take with him in his cart at work. The radio also had a hidden transmitter. Kenny could keep an ear on Dad all day. He would hide a signal booster near the lab so that he could listen from home. They interrupted Kenny's impromptu with a news bulletin. Britain and France were declaring war on Germany. They sounded surprised by Poland. Kenny wasn't. Even in German's unmusical consonants, Kenny could tell that Hitler was full of crap. His dad thought that trouble for England was a good thing. His dad was a Mick idiot. Sometimes scary, sometimes fun to listen to, but an idiot. Still, there was something in Hitler's Sprechensong that was overwhelming. You didn't care that it was crap. That was scary. Kenny would have to do something about that someday. Tuesday, October 15th, 1940. Kenny listened to the war. London thundered in symphony, no jazz. Murrow hears major bombing in C minor. Di-di-di-da! Morse for V for victory, with the 9th Air Group flying by for Hitler's ode to death. Keen. Time for the local news. Kenny tuned in to his father's work. He could relax. Dad was still there. Maybe he could pick up some more labs talk that would help his radio designs. Maybe he could hear people bossing Dad around. Hey, O'Reilly, what you got there? A man's voice, a lot younger than Dad's. Open cadenced. Friendly. A radio, Michael. My 15-year-old son built it for me. May I take a peek? Go right ahead. Stations twisted. Pretty good reception and sound. Runs on that battery? Let me look here. A pause then. You've got a bright kid, O'Reilly. Could you bring him in to work with you tomorrow? I'd like to talk radios with him.
I don't know. He's in school. As usual, Dad was full of crap. What do you want to talk to him for?
It's important. I can talk to your supervisor about it, but...
No, I'll bring him.
Good. Tomorrow.
Kenny was nearly deafened. The man had said he wanted to talk radios with him, and real respect had animated his words. Something else there, too, but Kenny only heard the opportunity. The next day, Dad had Kenny accompanied to work for the first time. Kenny had been around there before, but solo to run his booster off a nearby power line. They walked towards West Street and the full-block Bell Labs complex. Their strides were accompanied by the slow, dark rhythm of a freight train passing overhead on the elevated high line and through a tunnel in the front building. Holy Robert Moses! On the 10th floor of the central building, they click-stepped through a chaotic open space of desks and tables, arranged with apparent randomness. The space echoed with working men. Finally, they reached an office, and Dad tapped. A young man squeaked the door open. You can leave him here,
said the voice from yesterday. But shouldn't. The young man grabbed Kenny's arm, pulled him in, and slammed the door. An older man stood behind a desk. On the desk was Kenny's radio, opened up, and parts scattered. The transmitter was at the center of the desk, and next to the transmitter, the booster.
Care to explain this, boy?
So Kenny explained his variations on existing design themes and parts. But this didn't seem to make the older man any happier. The younger man said,
That's interesting, kid. Fascinating, actually. But what I think he meant was, why?
So Kenny spoke son the melodrama of living alone with his father, how his father wasn't always nice, and that when he wasn't nice and was on his way home, Kenny wanted to be somewhere else.
But what about what we do here? Have you been listening to that?
Kenny grinned.
You bet! It's great stuff. I've got lots of ideas for it, if you'd like me to explain.
That's enough.
The old man was really angry now.
We should call the authorities.
You won't, said Kenny.
The younger man laughed unpleasantly and said,
Oh, really, kid? And why's that? You want something.
The older man glowered, angry silent. Kenny stood still, worried only about what his father would say later. The younger man looked at the older man and shrugged his shoulders. The older man sighed and nodded. The younger man offered his hand.
Kid, my name's Mike O'Neill. This is my boss, Mr. Carlton. We'd like to hire you.
Me? I'm only 16.
You're only 15, but you're the future. We want you to work on every aspect of improving radio transmission and reception. The pay's good. I'll be your supervisor. You'll be my noise man.
A noise man. That rang true. Kenny thought that working with Mike would be really swell. Tuesday, September 15th, 1942. On the night Kenny finally heard them say hello, he was listening for a signal on his new directional antenna, an enormous parabolic dish mounted atop a large tripod on the flat central roof of the Bell Laboratories complex.
You sure this Martian salad bowl is working, kid? Asked Mike.
Kenny held up an OK sign and tried to block out the noise. Even up here, this late, wearing a headset. Noise. It was just after midnight, and the city was blacked out for civil defense except for searchlights sweeping the sky. Kenny missed the happy chorus of the lighted city, the roaring crowds at Dodgers games, the shrieking rides at Coney Island. Instead, young men in uniform roamed the streets in herds, on their way to slaughterhouses across the Atlantic and Pacific, trying to shout away death, trying to drag Kenny with them. From the stairwell entrance, Kenny heard a faint clarinet. His father, no doubt dragging a mop and listening to his radio. During the day, his father stayed out of earshot, but now, with the building almost empty, every random sound reminded Kenny that Dad might be near. It was harder to keep an ear on Dad without the transmitter in his radio, but Kenny had found a way to keep an ear on everyone. Kenny now had much of the labs wired for sound. Sure, they had ways to detect listening devices, but not these, not yet. Kenny pointed at the stairwell door. Mike laughed. You a little nervous, kid? But he gently shut the door anyway. Now, focus. Kenny had the antenna set in a precise southerly alignment for a test transmission. They were trying for a clear signal in the minimum number of hops to the U.S. air bases in Brazil. Mike sat next to Kenny and put on his own headset. They waited. The test transmission came, 15 minutes straight of furiously scrawling dots and dashes. When the test was done, they cross-compared their scrawls. Amazingly, they agreed. The transmission was unambiguous at their end. Mike took off his headset and slapped Kenny on the back.
Good work, kid. We'll send this back tomorrow, but it sounds like this hunk of scrap is doing the job. Let's celebrate.
Mike pulled out a flask of whiskey and handed it to Kenny.
One mick to another, right, kid?
Kenny took a sip. It burned, but he didn't cough.
Thanks. Turned out they were the only two Irish in their section, though Mike was black Irish and Kenny was a fair redhead. At 25, Mike was also the youngest employee there besides Kenny. A swell guy. Christ, with the blackout, you can really see the stars, Mike pointed. There's science fiction heaven, Mars. He must be happy with us now. When Kenny had first built his antenna, he would aim it every now and then at Mars. Even if the Martians didn't want to visit this world at war, they might be broadcasting Martian news and music. Maybe from up there they could tell where Mom was. But that was just plain science fiction. Mike called him back from space. So, what else can you pick up on this thing? Kenny grabbed his headphones again. His favorite game was to find the farthest radio station signal he could. Maybe we can hear Brazil ourselves. Mike adjusted the antenna slightly to the southeast, at an altitude not far above the horizon. Anything? Not sure. Something was crackling, but Kenny was having trouble tuning the frequency to the sweet spot. Check the coil, would you? Kenny lightly jiggled the frequency. There, maybe... Screech! Spikes jabbed into both of Kenny's ears. Crap. His own damn fault for not paying attention. Mike had opened up the receiver unit and slid the frequency to the coil's far end for a better look. Mike laughed, roaring, "Take off the phones, Einstein!" Wait. A noise, so faint that Kenny wondered if it were just the echo in his brain of the test transmission. Only the beeps weren't Morse. They were faster, real fast. No operator could have written this down. Kid? Kenny signaled with his open palm to keep it quiet. What frequency? He whispered. Frequency? I don't know, kid. Must be like 1,000. 1,000 megacycles? Ridiculous. Nobody used that range. But there it was. Kenny felt his heart beating harder, and he tried to calm down so the rush in his ears wouldn't interfere with the signal. A freight train rumbled below. He blocked it out. The signal grew in intensity for a while. And then it faded. Kenny checked the antenna. Still steady, south by southeasterly, towards a nondescript patch of sky with few stars that he could see. Was the source moving? Mike had his pencil and paper ready again. Get this alignment. Sure, kid. Mike noted the precise degrees and minutes. Kenny checked his watch. It was 1 a.m., September 15th. Hello. Kenny took off the phones and sat down hard on the roof, letting his breath finally catch up with his excitement, trying to keep the sound fury in his brain from erupting in front of Mike. What the hell was that, kid? Germans? Japs? What? Kenny closed his eyes, remembering the signal. Radio! From the stars! Star people! Gosh and fudge all! If you're playing me... Kenny shook his head like a punch-drunk boxer. Okay, you're not playing me. Are you sure? Remember how that War of the Worlds show fooled people? Kenny remembered. He had known what was going on and was fooled anyway. Are you sure, kid? No, not sure. This was beyond anything Kenny had ever heard of. But we can check it tomorrow. We'll listen again at the same altitude and, azimuth, at around the same time. Mike nodded. Okay, I get you. We'll start a few minutes earlier. If it's spacemen, we'll get the same thing at an earlier time. Then what? We need recording equipment, said Kenny. The good stuff. Check, and... Then we got to chase the signal across the sky. Kid... You made the salad bowl to stand at attention, not march. But we'll manage. They got special motors and crap for telescopes to follow the sky evenly. And we'll need a telescope, too. Mike took a swig from the flask and wiped his mouth. Still, it might be natural fuzz. Another Bell Noise guy. You don't know him. Got radio from the whole galaxy. Just natural fuzz. This is different, said Kenny. It's a specific source. And if you could have heard it. No, it didn't sound natural at all. Science fiction becoming science fact.
We've got to tell people.
Whoa, hold on, said Mike. People already had enough to worry about with Nazis and Japs. Do you want to cause a panic like Orson Welles?
Kenny certainly didn't want that. No need to replay the night his mom left. No need to even think about that.
Don't worry, kid. I'll handle who we tell. Not Carlton, that's for sure.
Maybe we shouldn't tell anyone.
Kenny already had the job he wanted, playing with radios and listening for money. This might be too loud for him.
Yeah, Mike said, this might turn into a big job, and I'd rather be chasing skirts.
A false cadence to this, but most lies didn't matter. Kenny stared at the stars again. So many to listen to. His mom might be staring at them too.
Mother, he murmured at the sky.
Mike heard him.
Mother? What happened to your mother, kid?
Nothing. The Martians got her.
Right. Look, what if Hitler talks to these green men first? Nazi heat rays? We got to figure this out before they do.
Hitler talking crap to the spacemen. Not good. Some stupid sailors were yelling on the street, long after curfew. Kenny imagined them on deck and looking smart in their uniforms as a heat ray sizzled into their ship and knew that Mike was right. So that's my part of my story, Noise Man. You can listen to the rest of it on the website, which is, again, tomdoylewriter.com, and go to the audio tab there and select Noise Man, and you can either listen to the whole thing again or just from this point on. We're about a half hour into it, which is we'll mark it for audio listening purposes. Oh, yes, and tune in again next week for the further adventures of Kenny and Mike and the Spacemen.
Obviously, you want to look at the whole website, but for the closure of that particular story, click the audio tab.
A slight spoiler, characters such as Alan Turing show up, who really did come to New York during the war years. Mm-hmm. So it's good crypto history in that sense. And yeah. And I try to interweave it with the rest of it with actual events at their appropriate dates.
So let's tell people again who we are and what they're listening to. And yes, let's readjust the mic, sorry folks, so that we're both on mic now. And this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Tom Doyle. And again, to find TomDoyle.com.
TomDoyleWriter.com.
Excuse me, TomDoyleWriter.com. You'll find his website and a lot of readings on there. And,
yes.
Something from Fast Forward and reading from Balticon. And
a few things I did at home on my own little Yamaha home studio equipment, which was fun to play with.
Yeah, it is. And you're a good reader. So.
Oh, thank you,
John. Where was that story published?
This has been published for, this is one of the first time stories in the collection. So there are three of them that have not been previously published.
The collection?
The collection being The Wizard of Makatawa and Other Stories by myself.
By Tom Doyle.
Published by Paper Golem Books, which is Lawrence Schoen's outfit. Okay. And he selected these three from my previously unpublished work. And this one is a story that, because of its length, I think had trouble finding a market. There were people who liked the story, and so it's the perfect sort of story to have in a collection, one where the quality, in my estimation, was probably sufficient, but the length simply placed it out of most markets.
Yeah, it puts it in markets because it's so meta. It refers to so many other things that are happening and other people that are around, and does so in a delightful way. And otherwise, the only thing editors want are depressing stories.
Ah, that would seem to be the case. There are people who are revolting against that online, I've heard.
They're trying to
put anthologies together with titles like Sunshine or such.
Yeah, it's time to move on from it was happening before 9/11, so it's just time to move on and bear a grin. And maybe the song we should go out with is Sunny Side of the Street or
there
something
you go.
Like from that.
This story was first started back at Clarion, and it was during the Kelly Link Gavin Grant week. And they were quite helpful on it. And it was actually, it started further back than that. I had been trying my hand at screenplays, and that went nowhere. But I had done a screenplay about kind of the modern results of this backstory. And then I go, well, why don't I go back and write the backstory to it? And the modern thing was kind of an X-Files-ish comedy. But as I got into writing the backstory, it became a lot grimmer and more serious and a little darker as it goes along. And so that became much more interesting than the
get studios again, I may challenge you and ask you to write it as a radio drama, because that's what it wants to be.
Oh, that would be great. That would be absolutely appropriate. And then you'd have a radio drama within the radio drama, recreating the War of the Worlds broadcast and the station changes. That would be wonderful if you get to.
Yeah. But we have to, but radio drama is something we have to continue.
Well, it's great to see science fiction being used for theater stagings these days everywhere. New radio drama.
Everywhere, would you say, really?
Oh, not everywhere, but Portland and here and hip places, I guess I should say. But not across the country, but not everywhere. So
Did you listen to old time radio?
I have listened to old time radio. I go back and listen to a lot of the X-1 shows for science fiction stories. While I was out for the Writers of the Future Award last year, one of these stories in the collection is from that anthology. I got to hear a radio play. I got to see a radio play being staged.
Oh, who did that?
It was a bunch of folks. I forget. I'll get
it
to
a
the program.
Or anything like that?
I forget the name of the company.
Okay, I'm interested. Who's doing radio plays out there? Because it's not too common. Although the Writers of the Future people have money.
Yes.
For very nasty reasons, but they're still a great organization.
Well, they paid me for the story, so I don't want to comment on any.
I have nothing but respect for Writers of the Future. But it's just that every so often, for those who are unaware, Writers of the Future is... comes through Galaxy Press. They bought that name. And Galaxy Press is an offshoot of Bridge Publications, and Bridge Publications is a part of Scientology.
I'm not even going to
comment. I'm just stating what they send me, in the press releases. But everybody I know who's been involved with the Writers of the Future as a contest, as an organization, as a publishing thing, everybody has had nothing but good things to say, that they were never approached, that the judges are not a part of that organization. It is a totally free and open thing.
It was a lot of fun, too. And I got to meet folks like Tim Powers and Nina Kuricki Hoffman and folks. Unfortunately, Katie Wentworth passed away.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. She was sick, and so I was not able to meet her.
Yeah, the only...
There you go. Yeah. Well, that was... If this one hadn't been so appropriate for New York and radio, that would have...
Well, that would be another choice, and hopefully we will have you back, but then you're probably going to have to read a novel.
I will probably, yes, hopefully.
Yes.
Oh, going on.
So, it is time for us to call for closure of this episode, but it's taken so long, we're going to have to do more, especially when the novel comes out.
Well, I look forward to it. It's always great to be here and talk to you. Or talk to you anywhere. So.
Well, thank you so much. So, again, I have been here with Tom Doyle. And go to TOMDOYLEWRITER.com for more information. And one has to be careful with the radio. They don't see it printed there. Well, once again, thank you, and we'll do this again soon.
Thank you, Jim.
Good morning, America. How are you?
Hope you're having a great birthday. You look great.
Well, that was certainly not what I had planned on playing at that point. I was going to play Ken Gale's promo that he was going to be doing my show next week. So why don't I just tell you, Ken Gale will be here next week. I'm going to be at ReaderCon. I like to go up early, and Ken always has good stuff and interesting stuff. And stay tuned to WBAI, and at some point you will hear that promo. In the meantime, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way over these airwaves in just about 3.5 minutes. Happy 4th of July. I will be back in 2 weeks. We have a lot of great shows coming up, including one with Moira Crone, another one with Sharon Lee and Steve Miller, and just yesterday recorded a great, great, great show with Kate Elliott. And then I'm going to be doing a whole bunch of things at ReaderCon. So, we're going to have a good summer. Stay tuned, stay cool, and enjoy yourselves. Good morning. Oh yeah, if you'd like to write me, please, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Also, join the Facebook group, Hour of the Wolf, and stuff like that there. Good morning again.
Non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
Peace. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God.
It's been years since Enough Said Theme was on the air here, and next Wednesday overnight I'll be catching up on years of comics history and current events, including the mainstream, independent graphic novels, and internet comic strips with Gina Donahue and Patrick Sharp, and you, as yours truly, Ken Gale, guest host for Jim Froin's science fiction show, Hour of the Wolf, this Wednesday night, Thursday morning, July 11th, from 1:30 to 3 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Enough said. Cyclops, angel, and
Doctor Strange. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Before you continue on with your day, I'd like to ask you to visit the website at WBAI.org and consider becoming a BAI buddy. For as little as $10 a month, you can help the station and make a recurring donation on behalf of this program. As a BAI buddy, you receive a WBAI membership card, as well as very nice discounts at area museums and various local facilities, and selected WBAI supported events, and all donate a free CD, no charge to the station. It's a safe, secure, and easy way for you to support this 52-year-old commercial-free listener-sponsored radio station, WBAI.org. Thank you for your support.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to spell it. I am a proletarian. I am
the fish. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, or that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Born the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my heart is internal, the American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ash. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn.
1989 Sinker. This is July 4th. WBAI. 4 o'clock. Burn another imperialist flag. 5 o'clock. About 10 imperialist flags burn to ashes, y'all. This is July 4th. The show is called Burn Baby Burn. And you know why we had to name the show Burn Baby Burn, y'all.
Come along with me. Let's take a trip. But this time not on a slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama. Talking about Peru. Azania. Brixton. Belfast. Can't forget Korea. Beirut. Can't forget Haiti. Iran. Puerto Rico. Colombia. Mexico. Talking about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua. East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will. Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave. The free. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you.
F you.
America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it.
99 Sinker, list the line right here. Unfortunately, the record is banned. Or rather censored right here, 99 Sinker. Safe harbor doesn't mean anything right here because there's no such thing as free speech in imperialist America, especially when your show is named Burn Baby Burn, where we burn the imperialist flag to ashes, y'all. Yo, we'll burn the imperialist flag to ashes, y'all. Yo, listen up, here we go. This is July 4th. 2013, y'all. 10,000 reasons and more to burn imperialist flag to ashes, y'all. The show is dedicated to Edward Snowden. You know what I mean? Yeah. The show is dedicated to the president of Bolivia, where these imperialist countries wanted to shoot his plane down, push his plane down, whether it had Edward Snowden or not, y'all. Yeah. Burn, baby, burn.
Your girls are told them, say girls are told them. When she walk, no dog can bark. Say when she walk, no dog can bark. Big hips, girl, my your boss. Right.
Yo, it's flag burning day, the peak of the flag burning season right here. Grab the red, white, and blue imperialist old glory and burn it to ashes. If it won't burn, dip it in acid. Barbecue in the red, white, and blue until 5 o'clock just for you.
Dope boys, stone at you. Dope boys, stone at you. Your girls are told them. Say girls are told them. Dope boys, stone at you. Dope boys, stone at you. Your girls are told them. I will me say. Dope boys, stone at you. Dope boys, stone at you. Your girls are told them. Your girls are told them. Dope boys, stone at you. Dope boys, stone at you. Your girls are told them. Say girls are told them. When she walk, no dog can bark. Say when she walk, no dog can bark. Big hips, girl, my your boss. Right. Big hips, girl, man, you bust me head. You must see one face, see me drop down dead, eh? You must see one face, see me drop down dead. I wear me say, duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. Two girls a toe them. Say girls a toe them. Duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. Two girls a toe them. Say girls a toe them. 5 and 5 and 10 and so you go around the bend. You go around the bend and then you tell a little friend. Better duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. So girls that show them, so girls that show them. The girl sister Pat said she's so big and fat. Tell your sister Pat know where it's really at. But when she walk, no dog can bark. Say when she walk, no one a sky lock. Them dust duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. So girls that show them, so girls where head. Duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. Say girls that show them, lad. She bust me hygiene head like a liquor. And me say, bust me hygiene head, a man he nearly dropped dead. Him went to the doctor fi take 10 stitch. Doctor said to him, boy you are a lucky bitch. Duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. So girls that show them, say girls that show them. Duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. A girls that show them, say girls that show them. But when she walk, no dog, no deer bark. When she walk, no dog, no deer bark. So when she walk, no one a skylark. And when she pass, them start whisper and talk. Say duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. So girls that show them, blue flag me head. Duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. So girls that show them. Say girls I told them, she bust me hiding head and make him get 10 stitch. Doctor said to him, boy you are a lucky bitch. Duck boys, stone a toe. Duck boys, stone a toe. So girls I told them. Say girls I told
them. Don't you cut off your dreadlock. Let it go, let it go.
Lister on the radio.
Don't you cut off your dreadlock. Let it go till it reach your
who's
toe.
Got the weed, aya?
Samson was a dreadlock, but he played a fool. Samson was a dreadlock, so Delilah betrayed him. Don't you cut off your dreadlock, because Georgia will chastise you. He will hurt you. Don't you cut off your dreadlock. Let it go, let it go, let it go. Oh, oh, oh. Thing that dreadlocks man is an evil man. But let me tell you something, dreadlocks man is a righteous man. So don't you cut off your dreadlocks. Let it go, oh, oh. Don't you do it, my brother. Let it go, let it go.